There's a lot to enjoy about winter. You've got those dazzling landscape, you got getting out on skis or snowshoes, and a whole lot more. Also, some less fun things we can think about. Frozen faces, and of course, shoveling. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Lori Tynebrody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. Great to see you, Lori.
It's good to be here.
Bill Boisenault with us as well. Bill, a professor at the UW School of Medicine Public Health, a senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Bill, good to see you.
Always good to be back. Thank you, Larry.
I think all of the state has some snow on the ground, if I'm not mistaken, and likely more in the forecast. What should we be keeping in mind to help us avoid injuries caused by shoveling?
Hiring the neighbor kid.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Buying a snowblower.
Exactly. Helping the economy. Shoveling. So my 14-year-old was giving me the business because I went out in that last snowfall and I shoveled after we got a couple inches of snow. And it was still supposed to snow more. He's like, well, why are you shoveling now? You're going to have to shovel again tomorrow. And I said, because I'd rather shovel 2 inches twice than 4 inches once.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he noodled on that for a while. But, you know, for me, pushing and lifting that much snow... Yeah. Hurts. I mean, it just hurts. So I'd rather shovel again, having taken a break and have less snow to push. So that's one strategy.
Yeah. It's kind of a good and bad. I mean, it's good exercise. Cardiovascular is good exercise, and you're working muscle groups. But especially the first couple of big snows in particular, we're not used to shoveling. And like anything else, you start a new activity, and it's intense, and it's heavy, and it's wet snow. It can cause injuries. I mean, everything from back injuries, shoulder problems, heart problems.
Yeah.
So there's lots of risk, especially if people are relatively sedentary, and then they said, I'm going to get some exercise, and I'll go shovel. And, you know, back injuries are probably the most common.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where people get into trouble, it's the repetition of bending, twisting with your trunk flexed forward. That combination mm-hmm. of bending and twisting can get lots of people into trouble. And twisting through your back as opposed to twisting through your legs. When you pick up that snow and the shovel, it's best to pivot on your feet as opposed to twisting at the waist. And that keeps a lot of pressure off the back. And then, like Lori said, either you try to do it in segments if time allows, if your life allows. It's better to shovel 2 or 3 inches as opposed to 6 or 8 inches at one time, especially if it's the wet, heavy stuff.
Yeah, and people tend to have one motor program for shoveling, and that is their right-handed or their left-handed, and they shovel the same way over and over. If in a lighter snowfall, you can teach yourself to shovel using your other hand so that you are not bending and twisting and lifting and loading your spine in the same fashion over and over again, that'd be great. And I wouldn't recommend it with a heavy snowfall because you probably don't have the coordination or the skill level for it. But to train yourself to do it a different way, and or getting yourself a pushing shovel and a lifting shovel so that
you
can...
Yeah, I was wondering about shovels. Mm-hmm. What is the difference?
Well, in a pushing kind of shovel, it acts a little bit like a snow plow. You're more upright. And the way the handles are generally made is you can use two hands that are symmetrical and you can push straight forward. Whereas in a traditional shovel, you have your hands in a line and your trunk has to rotate and flex, as Bill said. So you're just in a different posture using different muscle groups. So it changes it up some.
Does the length of the shovel make much difference? I mean, they're pretty much all the same length, I think.
Well, you know, I just got a new shovel. My pushing shovel has a much longer handle than my lifting shovel. I'm much more upright because I'm kind of tall. Anything with a longer handle is going to be better for me. So they do come in different lengths. So you need to get one, if you can, to fit your body.
Yeah, your height. That's the key. People who are taller, they've got to bend further to get to it and then more twisting. And so if you can get one, if you're taller and get one longer length, that's going to help you.
Someone here at the station said, you know, I'm a little stiff from the snowblower, which I thought,
Well, you know, you have the pull, first of all, if you don't have an electric start. So you have that component. And I've never had a snowblower, but my guess is they're heavy. they look like they're heavy, and the vibration. Mm-hmm. Vibration is generally not good for your joints.
Yeah. Generally, it is less stressful than shoveling, clearly.
Yeah.
But if the snow is dense packed, it takes some work to get the snowplow through it, a snowblower through it. And again, you're just using muscles differently. Even if people are in fairly good condition, you use muscles differently. You're going to have kind of post-activity stiffness and soreness the next day, maybe 2 days. The other thing, too, is since both the snow blowing and shoveling requires bending forward, you know, every so often just stopping and standing up straight and stretching backward, just, you know, move your trunk in the opposite direction can help a bit as well.
I can tell you from experience, I have several snow shovels, and I also have a snow blower, and I have an electric start on my snow blower. And I recommend to anybody buying a snow blower that they get an electric start because the amount of pushing on that electric start to get it going, especially the first time around, I mean, I would never use mine if because I would never get it started without the electric.
Yeah, and yanking on that cord, like Lori said before, you know, maybe a dozen times, especially the first time you get it started.
Oh.
It's tough on the shoulders. It's tough on the back. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah. And when you're pushing that snowblower, try to push with your legs and your hips. I think the tendency is to push with your arms and shoulders because you think of pushing with your arms as an upper body activity. Really try to keep your arms and upper trunk as fixed as you can and push with your legs and hips. That's where your strength is.
Yeah. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, our physical therapists, our guests today here on the Ideas Network. Maybe you've got an ache, a pain, a sprain, or a strain. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mailer Show. You have a designated shoveler in your house? I am in our house. Maybe you've had an injury as a result. I hope not. But if you did, that'd be another question to ask about. Valerie in Grafton has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Hi, Val.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a two-month-old daughter, and when we went in for her well child checkup, she has a fairly substantial flat spot on one side of her head, and her doctor said she might need physical therapy for it. I was wondering if there's any exercises or any additional things we can do to kind of prevent physical therapy.
Yeah, the flat spot in infants, it's not uncommon. The term for it is plagiocephaly, or in essence, you know, a flat head or flat spot. And there's different causes of it. Most common is positional. Infants tend to sleep and lie down in one position primarily, and the bones making up the cranium or skull are not fused or fixed yet, very soft and pliable. And so it's usually due to the position that they're in for so many hours out of the day. And so it's not uncommon. Generally, as kids get older and start getting more mobile, assuming more positions, then the skull takes its more normal shape, typical shape. In terms of exercises, Val, I'm not sure about specific exercises as opposed to depending on where the flatter area is from a positional standpoint is to try to have the weight of the head on another part of the skull. But I'm not aware of any specific exercises to fix that or work on that. I know there are kind of special helmets. Basically, it's an orthosis, like you would put a splint on somebody's wrist or on their ankle. There are splints that almost like a football helmet that infants wear for a number of months. That also can make a big difference on kids.
Mm-hmm.
So was that discussed at all, Val, when you went in?
No, she just said we were going to keep an eye on it for another month, and if it didn't get better, we would physical therapy.
Okay. You know, there are physical therapists who are specialists in pediatric area, and that's not me. So I can tell you more from my own personal experience and what I've seen with infants that I've known. So there may be exercises, but when I think about the most common cause of this, I'm not sure there's an exercise that's really going to fix that outside of just trying to vary where the pressure falls on the young one's head.
Right. And it may be, the path of least resistance. If there's this flat spot now, when your daughter falls asleep, her head may just gravitate to that position because it's the most compatible with the surface. So you may use some towel rolls or something like that to keep her head, or the little head supports that you use in your car seat. You might find that useful to put into her bed to keep her head in a specific position.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck, Val.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. Heather in Monona. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call.
Hey, I'm calling to make a pitch for what I think is a much better way to move snow, and that's a snow scoop. Has anybody heard about those?
Is that the big scoop in front of you with the big handle?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like a big, what would be on the end of a...
Right.
I don't know, some sort of contractor device, but it has a U-shaped handle.
Yep.
And all you do is push it forward and basically lift your arms where you want to dump it and then kind of take a step back or two. I have a mess of structural problems, and if I had to go out and shovel snow now, I couldn't do it. But with the snow scoop, I can.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen those. Those look great. I don't have one of those, but they look like another nice alternative.
Yeah.
I encourage anybody with hand, back, hip, any kind of problem like that to try it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the advantages, like Lori described before, is you can do a lot of the pushing with your legs and pushing through your trunk and not just using your arms or your shoulders. And it gives you a little different leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And on purchasing it, I would advise my ex-boyfriend had an aluminum one, and it was kind of heavy. And then my neighbor who moved away had a plastic one with a metal front edge, and that's much lighter and easier to maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
And had another person call in, anonymous caller, said he or she uses a broom before the snow gets too wet and heavy. A heavy-duty broom works wonders, removing snow before it freezes, mm-hmm. those first snows. And that's true. Mm-hmm. I actually have a broom on my front porch, and mm-hmm. I use the broom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if it's a light powdery snow,
it works wonderful.
It's the heavy wet stuff that gets people into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Rick in Monona, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. I'm enjoying your program. I have a question that's not related to snow shoveling. My son. Was a football player last year for Monona Grove High School, and he was a pretty big guy. And when season ended, he started to lose weight because he wanted to get back down to his more proportional body weight. And he lost around 50 pounds, and now he's got the sort of a belly roll at around his waist that's really like bothering him. And we've been trying to get an answer to what happens to that when people lose a lot of weight and they have excess skin. What can we expect to happen to that? Will it shrink? Or will it stay there? Is there anything that he could do to take?
Yeah.
Well, let's back up a little bit. So when he was playing football, was it mostly muscle or did he have excess trunk fat?
Well, when he was a kid, he was a little bit chubby.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he got to about 14, he grew taller. But and then he put on a lot of muscle because they do a lot of pumping iron over there. But I think he probably still had, I think that the remnants of that belly that he had when he was 8 years old, 9 years old, kind of just always stayed there.
Okay. And how old is he now?
He's going to be 19 in January.
Okay. So he's generally lean. Is he still strong? Is he weightlifting yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's in shape. He works out all the time.
Okay. And, so but he's still
he's in good shape.
And so this belly roll, is this just skin, or is
it's excess skin, and then maybe a little bit of fat that's in there that's still left over. But I mean, his body mass, I bet that he's probably went down to what, 10% body.
Oh my, okay. Hmm. All right.
I mean, I think that's it. I'm guessing.
Okay. And his abdominal muscles are pretty strong.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because usually the first thing you do, you think about is strengthening the muscle underneath that skin.
Uh-huh.
So he may have a genetic predisposition, you know, based upon what you said about how he was growing up, to hold any excess body fat in his trunk and abdomen. So the first thing to remember across his lifetime, that's the most unhealthy place to carry body fat. Uh-huh. So he needs to really maintain that lifestyle of fitness and exercise that he has started at this point in his life. So that's really great. What happens to the skin? It's a little hard to say. He's still young, so I would hope that over time, some of that skin will, I don't know, what would be the word, Bill?
I guess tighten up.
Tighten up,
That's really not anatomically correct, but tighten up.
Yeah. Generally, your connective tissue, all of it responds to the length it sits at. So one of the things that we talk about from a postural point of view is if you sit with bad posture, the muscles on the back of your shoulder blades will lengthen. Similarly, the cells in your skin will lengthen when they're stretched. So if they're no longer stretched, you may see over time, and we're talking months to years, those cells responding to that. But if he goes back and gains weight again in his belly, the more times he does that, the harder it's going to be to get rid of that skin. So I just give it some time. And, you know, if in a couple of years it's still bothersome to him, then you might talk to somebody about, you know, there might be a surgical procedure for that if it's really bothersome.
A tummy tuck.
Yeah.
Right. Plastic surgeon.
Yeah. But the good news is the younger he is, the more, we call it plastic, the more his cells will respond to changes in loading. So he may benefit from that. But in the meantime, it serves as a reminder that he's got to stay fit.
Yep. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with physical therapist Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault, and we have some open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, and our on-air producer, Carl Christensen, will be happy to take your call. Again, it's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. Willem wondered if there's any strengthening exercises for tennis elbow.
Oh, yeah. We love talking about tennis elbow. So tennis elbow historically has been treated by decreasing the load on the tendon, usually by using a wrist splint. And although it doesn't seem necessarily intuitive, the pain at tennis elbow actually comes from the origin of the muscles that move your wrist. So anytime you move your wrist or grip, because gripping also uses those same muscles, it causes pain in the elbow. And if it's in your dominant arm, gripping, lifting, turning doorknobs, those are things you do all day long. So it's hard for it to rest. So they usually will give you a wrist splint and then sometimes a strap around your elbow. The exercise treatment typically involves some heavy resistance exercises in what we call the negative phase of a muscle contraction, and that is the lowering phase. And it's a little bit tricky to do, but it would be best to get a consultation with a PT who can kind of guide them through the process, because they figure out what the maximum amount of weight is that you can lift, and then they establish a program that includes both the amount of weight and the speed with which the exercise is performed. And the research has shown that that's probably one of the more effective ways to deal with this. Simply strengthening typically doesn't do the job for most people. So I'd recommend a visit to the PT.
Yeah, and when somebody has tennis elbow, Lori, correct me if I'm wrong, the eccentric exercise, that negative exercise, it can be painful in the beginning.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
But it's a good pain to be able to work through as you try to remodel the scar tissue.
Yeah.
So, you know, and pain following exercise should last from this time maybe an hour afterward, max?
Or a couple hours, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, historically, we always said, you know, when you're exercising, you shouldn't have pain. This is one of those cases where we've learned that you really need to, it needs to be painful for it to work.
Okay. Alan, by the way, in Silver Lake, let us know that he uses a leaf blower on snow instead of shoveling when he can. If you've got a fluffier snow, the heavy, it's just, I mean, the heavy stuff, I don't know how you could do it with a heavy.
No, that wouldn't work. You can't even push wet leaves with a leaf blower when they're wet.
Yeah, but I love that idea.
Yes.
It's a great idea. And then Dave from Wisconsin Rapids sent us a note. Sprained his ankle a week ago while shoveling snow. No longer hurts, but it's stiff around the ankle bones. He put ice on it initially and then switched to heat and ice later in the week. What about eliminating that stiffness? What do you do for that?
Well, typically, if it's a garden variety ankle sprain, it's going to take a while. Those tissues are going to take really months to remodel and heal because that kind of connective tissue has a poor blood supply. So it takes a long time for it to remodel. It's going to be stiff. So in the meantime, we typically start people on some strengthening exercises, you know, toe raises, sidestepping, resistive band exercises to strengthen the muscles around the ankle joint. We start them on balance exercises because balance exercises are really key to preventing a recurrence of the sprain. In terms of the stiffness, honestly, it's going to be stiff as it remodels. And the idea is just to keep moving it. That is, if you're sitting around, ankle up and down and in and out through a comfort zone. Not, you don't want to bring it in towards your big toe to the point where it hurts, because then you're going to be overstretching that healing tissue. But just keeping it moving, doing the alphabet with your foot, drawing figure eights, making circles up and down, in and out. Then it's just going to take some time.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Tom in Oregon next. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I've been having trouble with my left TMJ joint. Not so much pain, but just almost constant clicking, high-pitched clicking, so something slipping. I went to my doctor. They suggested see a dentist. I got a mouth guard made. I've worn that for, I guess, 8 or 9 weeks now, and it doesn't seem to be helping. So I'm wondering if there's physical therapy that can be done to either strengthen that whatever's around that jaw muscle or jaw joint or... You know, any other suggestions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the TMJ, the temporomandibular joint, are our jaw joints. And like any other joint in the body, they can be sprained. You can develop some arthritic changes. There's a disc inside that joint that is somewhat analogous or similar to the meniscus in our knee. And sometimes the disc can lose its position. It's not lined up exactly where it needs to be. And it can cause sound. And the fact that it's right by your ear sounds pretty loud. There is a role for physical therapy and certainly a role for dentists as well. Our occlusion, how our teeth come together, impact what's happening within both jaw joints. And so if your teeth are not aligned, they're not hitting the way they need to, that can cause undue stress on the joint and cause some degenerative changes over time. Some people's just the opposite. It's primarily a jaw problem that impacts how your teeth come together. And so starting with the mouth splint is an appropriate place to start. 8 or 9 weeks, if that was the primary problem, Tom, you should be noticing less clicking at this point. And so a physical therapist visit, they would evaluate, you know, the mobility, the flexibility and strength of the muscle groups around that area. They could look at the mouth splint and tie that into what they're feeling related to your jaw movement, seeing and feeling with your jaw movement. And sometimes there are exercises that can be done to just promote better movement at that joint. You know, the clicking, there's different patterns of clicking. Some people have only an opening click. Some people have what's called a reciprocal click, where it clicks when it opens and closes. And that means different things clinically and in terms of types of exercises. So those are all the things that a physical therapist would look at, Tom, when you go in. So based on how long you've had this and the splint has had 2 months trial, I'd recommend seeing a physical therapist. And All physical therapists have had some training in this area, but whatever clinic you call, I would ask if there's someone who has the most experience, and that would be the person to see.
Yep. There you go, Tom. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Our UW physical therapist, Bill Boys in Alton, Lori Time Brody, our guests. Larry Mueller here. Betty in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a Baker's cyst in the back of my left knee, and it was diagnosed about 12 years ago. And in the past year and a half, I've really upped my exercise program to about 5 days a week. And I'm noticing I'm starting to get some numbness and tingling back there. And I'm wondering if the exercise is aggravating it or if it grows. I'm just curious.
Can you feel that cyst?
Yes.
Okay. And is your sense that it's getting bigger or changing in any way?
Yeah, because I get some numbness and tingling down my calf from that area.
Okay. You know, a Baker's cyst is a like a bubble on a tire. It's a weakness in your joint capsule. So the normal synovial fluid in your joint pushes out the back through that weak spot, and you get this sort of bubble there. In your case, it must be causing some pressure on a nerve or a neurovascular bundle in the back of your knee. So if you haven't had this evaluated lately, I would go in and have it looked at. You don't want to be constantly pushing on that nerve, causing those numbness and tingling symptoms, because eventually it can become progressive, and you'll have more constant tingling. So it'd be better to handle this while you're still feeling occasional tingling. And it may be that your exercise program needs to be modified. We think about exercise in terms of frequency, intensity, and duration. You said you increased your exercise program, but those parameters can be manipulated to keep kind of your exercise volume the same, but changing it around within your program so that it's not causing that aggravation to your knee. But you really should get it evaluated at this point to see what's going on because you're getting a progressive increase in your symptoms.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dale in Green Lake. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you bet. Hi, folks. Years ago, when my kids were small and we played ping pong or baseball, I would use my opposite hand and arm so we'd be somewhat at a par. And I believe in preventative medicine. Earlier in the show when you said to possibly shovel with your opposite hand, that would help the back. I think it's great preventative medicine for us seniors. We know about strengthening our core, but there are so many advantages of strengthening our non-dominant side. I can attest to it because I took a dinger off rollerblades a couple years ago and had to have rotator cuff surgery on my right side. Well, my left side, my non-dominant side, was somewhat attuned to being involved in my life. So just the support for training that opposite side for strength and balance and injury.
Oh.
So thank you for that tip. And it can be a hoot, too. Try ironing now with my left hand.
Yeah, be careful of the activity.
Yeah, try brushing your teeth for a couple of weeks with your opposite hand. It's a lot of fun. Just a comment.
Thanks, Dale.
Dale's right. Sometimes you have to kind of force yourself or remind yourself that you have another arm or another hand to use. And, you know, when you really have a dominant arm, then without thinking about it, that's what you default to with all kinds of activities. And sometimes it's a forced issue, like this rotator cuff problem, where you have to use your other hand now and arm. And so it's good advice.
I think it's great advice to practice doing that stuff with your opposite arm. It's great training for your brain. There's a lot of, you know, crossover symmetry, bilateral transfer. There's a lot of support for it from a physical and a physiologic point of view.
Phil Mickelson, the great golfer, is right-handed. And plays golf left-handed.
Left-handed. Mm. I didn't know he was right-handed.
His dad taught him to play left-handed because the courses generally are easier, a little bit easier on left-handed players. and they tend to make the more of the problems if you're right-handed.
Right.
So that's the point is the guy's right-handed except when he plays golf, and then he's left-handed.
Wow!
So
you should try that for my golf game.
Yeah. I'd probably hardly be able to tell the difference in mine. Oh man, Leslie in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi guys, I am a nursing assistant, and my sole purpose in life is to give people showers and bed baths. And I go into people's homes daily and get people washed up. And if I'm in the shower with somebody, the floor tends to get slippery, my shoes are soaked, and I'm trying to keep good posture while getting every square inch of a person's body. How do I keep my body from not tightening up in between people and having to get into the car and going to see somebody else? Because, you know, when you're done exercising or doing a physical task, your body tends to cool down and get stiff. How do I maintain not getting so stiff?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's kind of the occupational hazard that goes with your vocation, that's a lot of trunk flexion bending forward. Couple things to recommend. During on the job itself, whenever you have an opportunity to stand up straight, and I'm sure you're probably doing this to a degree already, and then do some arching backward. You know, just put your hands on your hips and just gently stretch backward. You know, kind of think of when you're in the shower and bathing these folks as having your finger bent up toward the ceiling. You hold it there long enough, it gets stiff and sore. And ultimately, what you want to do is to bend that finger in the opposite direction. And the more you can do that with your trunk, your spine during the workday, the better. When you're driving, having a really good lumbar support would be important for you. There's a lot of car seats that kind of force us into a posterior pelvic tilt, or we round out our back, and that's like bending forward. And so having a small throw pillow or a towel roll in the small of your back, so when you are in the car, that you're not assuming that slump posture or position. And then outside of work, in terms of exercise and activity, you know, you need good hip flexibility, Leslie, so you can do more bending through your hips than your back. And you need good strength through the core and the hips, and not just your abdominals, but, you know, all around, the side musculature and back. And so I don't know if you're in any kind of a regular exercise routine in terms of core stabilization and flexibility, but with your occupation, where you're in similar positions for much of your day, it would be really important for you.
Do you have, like water shoes that you wear that can get wet in the bathroom so that you can, you know, move your feet around as you need without worrying about your shoes getting wet?
Well, I've chucked that out the window a long time ago because it's inevitable that your shoes are going to get wet. But no, I don't have an adequate pair of shoes. Do you happen to know of a good pair of, like, nursing shoes that would be more appropriate than, say, Nikes?
No, and I don't know that a pair of nursing shoes would be more appropriate. Are your shoes getting wet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they make really good supportive shoes that are meant to go in a pool, that are designed like a tennis shoe, but they're designed to get wet so that they wouldn't be ruined if they got wet. I don't know if you can change into that kind of a shoe when you get into the person's house, so that you have good support and good traction, but they're designed to be on a slippery surface.
Okay.
So you can look online or check in a aquatic store, a swimming pool store, and there's a variety of brands. They're not just a slip-on kind, but they have a full-on tying tennis shoe that's meant to go in the water for people who do water aerobics.
Have you ever tried Crocs?
Cool. The majority of them are
too slippery
on top.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I go through the tread pretty quick.
Yeah.
Now, I have one more question. I am so sorry. Now, I have arthritis in my hips. What is the best exercise to do to strengthen up my hips and to keep those moving? And I'll take your answer off the phone.
All right. Thank you.
No, good questions, Leslie. It's a combination of things that people need when they have arthritis around any joint, including the hip. And you need flexibility, and generally stretches, the kind of submaximal stretches that are held for 20 to 30 seconds, and stretching all around the hip, the quadriceps in the front, the hamstrings behind, some of the deep hip rotators, and then doing strengthening not only through the hips but up into the trunk. And there's a variety of exercises that are generally friendly to the joint so you don't mm-hmm. cause more problems. And then things aerobically, you know, a lot of pounding. If Leslie is a runner or does jumping activities, that puts more stress on the hip joints. So it doesn't mean she can't do those things, but mixed with biking or swimming where you get good strengthening around the joint, but you don't get the pounding associated with those kinds of activities. You know, it sounds like if Leslie hasn't, you know, seeing a physical therapist for a visit or two and bring in these great questions, and they should be able to design a good program for her that she can do at home and do on her own schedule could be very helpful.
Yeah. Thanks again for that call. I appreciate it very much. I have another tip about shoveling from Deborah. Deborah says, I slip on ice cleats for ice fishing over my boots before I go out to shovel, and I never slip. And I could believe that because those clips are great, those cleats. She says, I also use one of those funny-looking shovels with the bent handle. Mm-hmm. These two things really help get me through the snow season.
Yeah, the cleats is a really good idea. We've talked about, you know, pushing with your legs and doing more through your legs and trunk. Well, footwear is critical.
Yeah.
You know, Dave called before with an ankle sprain. I'm not sure the details of how he sprained his ankle, but if you don't have good footwear, you're going to be slipping and sliding, and then your body mechanics are all over the map. So.
Yeah, very, very good points. And what is it about the bent handle? Is it?
I think the purpose of the bent handle is so that your forward arm doesn't have to, you don't have to flex your trunk as much. Because if you have a straight handle, you have one hand close to the top and the other hand has to reach down farther.
Yeah.
But because of the bend, you don't have to bend quite as far because you hold it level and then it dips down.
Okay.
So I think it decreases the bending.
Makes sense. Douglas in Plainfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm having trouble with a joint in my little finger on my left hand. When I grasp something like a shoestring or a rope or a handle of something and have to close my fist tightly around this object, when I want to let go, the center joint, the joint next to the knuckle, does not want to straighten out. It bent too far and is trying to snap out of place.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And then can you take your finger and straighten it back out with your other hand?
I take the other hand and straighten it out. Mm-hmm. It's not real painful, but it is quite annoying that it gets hung up every time I do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Your fingers are designed with a bunch of pulleys that go around all these joints to give you that fine motor control you have. And what's happened in your case is some of those pulleys have slipped on the wrong side of their axis of rotation, so that after you bend your finger, they're not in the right position to straighten your finger back out. But if you take your hand, you can straighten it back out. You know, there's surgery to fix that, and I'm not sure that you want to do that. But in the meantime, you could see a hand therapist and see if they have any splints or things like that that can help with that. Is it only your little finger, or does it involve any other fingers?
Just the little finger on the left hand.
Yeah, and otherwise your hand is able to function as you need.
Yes.
And your elbow and so on.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so then it sounds like an isolated joint issue. So a hand specialist, they're a physical therapist and occupational therapist that specialize in hands. They're certified hand therapists, CHTs. So you can see one of those folks and see if they have a splint or any other suggestions for you for that. But honestly, as long as your hand is functioning pretty well and you can straighten your finger back out, that may be as good as it gets.
Yep.
Okay. I also have a recommendation for removing snow from roofs.
Yeah.
This thing is called a avalanche, and it's a sectioned handle you put together. The handle is maybe 15 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of this handle is a U-shaped rod bracket, only it's upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at the bottom of the open end of the U is an axle connecting the two sides of the bracket. And they're on wheels. The wheels are only maybe 2 inches in diameter. And on this axle is attached a quite sturdy plastic that's about 18 inches wide, which is
blade of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the width of this U-shaped thing. And the plastic is as long as the handle is. So when you start on the roof with the wheels on the shingles and push from the bottom up, the axle part actually cuts the snow loose from the shingles.
Yeah.
And by the time you get this pushed way up as far as you can reach, all of a sudden it all starts sliding down the plastic towards the operator.
Oh, geez, get
like
out of the way.
Avalanche, and it works tremendous.
But then you got to shovel it off your driveway.
Yeah.
But getting off the roof is a good thing.
Yeah, getting it off the roof is not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Douglas, thank you.
All right, thanks so much.
Appreciate it very much. Laurie Tyne, Brody, and Bill Boisenald, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, UW professors of, well, what, one's a professor, and well, you're both kind of a professor.
I'm a professor you're at a professor. Rocky Mountain, yeah.
Yeah, you're a professor at Rocky Mountain. Physical therapist Laurie Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenald, and we have, someone sent us an email of something, they call them Uper Scoopers, but it's a nice photo of one of these driveway clearers that has an optional wheel kit on it.
Yeah, the snow scoop, the big snow scoop.
The big snow scoop is what they are. So if you want to see what they look like, and one of the manufacturers at least, I hope you take a look online at our Facebook page. And Kim in Eau Claire has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for your show. I've been plagued with plantar fasciitis, and I've done a lot of different physical therapies. I've had my third cortisone shot, and the doctor's saying he cannot give me any more after this if it flares up again. I work out at the university here in Eau Claire in the kinesiology program, and the professor there was suggesting a few things, and I just want to avoid surgery because that's what the doctor is suggesting next. Is there any other suggestions to keep my plantar fasciitis away?
Well, let's back up. What have you had in physical therapy? What kind of things have you done?
Oh,
just so we don't tell you the same things you've already done.
Yeah, it's been quite a while since I've had physical therapy because it's been over 2 years since I've had physical therapy on it.
Okay. So you did some stretching, some strengthening, some ultrasound kind of a thing. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
I even did light therapy on it.
Okay. Did you ever use a night splint?
Yeah. Well, I have. I've got neuropathy.
Oh?
It drives the neuropathy crazy.
Hmm. Okay. And do you have this in 1 foot or both?
The plantar fasciitis?
Yeah.
Just in the one, in my left foot.
And do you know why, just in your left foot? Because most of the time, both of your feet are doing the same thing.
With the plantar fasciitis?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're walking, you're running, you're standing, you're climbing ladders.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it would just be the left foot.
Okay. And are you a regular exerciser, or were you?
Yes, and I'm also a letter carrier. So okay. I'm on my feet quite a bit.
Okay.
I've toned down exercising. I'm mostly doing biking now.
Okay.
Just to keep the weight off the foot. When I'm walking, it tends to bother it more.
Okay. All right. And so you've, I presume you've messed around with different shoes and things like that?
And yes, I've had.
And orthotics and, yeah. Okay. And have you tried different kinds of night splints, or did you try just like the posterior or the sock or?
No, I just had the one that was bent up at an angle.
And went behind your ankle?
Yeah, it was actually a whole like leg brace type deal.
Right, but it went behind your leg?
Yeah, behind my leg, and then I could adjust the angle, because you want the foot angled upward, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of your neuropathy, the other thing you could try with the night splint, because, you know, honestly, when you've done all those other things, a night splint is one of the better interventions. You might try an anterior night splint, and that's one that goes on the front of your ankle. So sometimes neuropathies get annoyed because you have that constant pressure on the bottom of your foot. This puts the pressure on the top of your foot. So you may find that works better. It's certainly worth a try. And then in terms of physical therapy, have they looked at your spine? Have they looked at how you carry your letter bag that may be impacting why your left foot is bothering you? Because honestly, we've seen people with where their low back or their SI joint is shifted or out of whack because of the asymmetry of what they do. And when they fix that, their distal symptoms actually resolve.
Well, what I've been reduced to now lately is a rolling, one of those rollers where
okay.
I've been rolling my muscles or my legs to kind of loosen up. I've had bad back. I've got I only have one normal lumbar. I've got a cracked disc, slightly bulged discs, arthritis in all the other ones, narrowing of the spinal column.
Okay, well, let me just sort of summarize that. If you haven't been to physical therapy for 2 years, I'd go back and have someone take a fresh look at you if you're trying to avoid surgery. Because frankly, if you have surgery, I'm not optimistic you're going to get better. Because to me, the source of your symptoms goes beyond just the local isolated plantar fascia at your foot. Because you have enough other stuff going on. Someone needs to take a look at you from stem to stern and get you some other advice.
Yep.
Also doing is with my feet, I've been like grabbing a towel, and that seems to have made it somewhat better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's sort of garden variety strengthening. So maybe fine-tuning that strengthening program. Maybe you're at a point now after your injections where physical therapy can actually get some traction.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Donald in Waukesha. Next. Hi, Donald.
Hi. Thank you for you guys' show there.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you, and I want to ask about, I have had an operation about 4 years ago in my back, and now I am experiencing a lot of tingling in my leg, in my left leg. It doesn't shift to the left foot, to the right leg, in the back of the left leg, and I was just wondering, is that normal or abnormal or what?
So, Donald, this tingling is new. You didn't have it before the surgery?
No, I didn't have it before the surgery. It happened after all the medication and all the stuff went back together, and I started having this tingling now, numbness in my legs, in the back of my legs.
Okay, all right. And how long have you been having? How many months have you had this, or weeks?
Well, it's been months in my left and my right two fingers, my index finger and my thumb. It's been there, and actually it's been in my foot also, in my right foot, and I kept ignoring that. Now it shifted from my right foot all the way down to my legs now, in my left leg and back of my left thigh there.
Okay, and did you have the surgery in your low back or your neck?
No, actually, in my back. I always had those neck pains also right after the surgery.
Okay. So it sounds like both are new, the tingling in your thumb and in your leg?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, have you seen anybody for this? Have you seen your surgeon for this or seen a physical therapist in the last month or so?
No, I haven't seen a physical therapist. I've been doing a lot of physical exercise, shoveling, shoveling a little light snow and doing a lot of physical things.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that activity is good, is good in general, but that may be stirring things up for you. I would start with the surgeon first and make sure they understand that you're having numbness and tingling in your hand as well as into your legs. And they'll not only look at your low back, but they'll look at your neck. The fact that it's in more than one limb is what makes it concerning, and that's why I hesitate just to make any kind of exercise recommendations. So they can check the status of your nerves and your spinal cord and then decide if rehabilitation is the right thing for you. So I'm really glad you called, but you need to be evaluated both your low back but also your neck try to figure out where this nerve compression is happening.
So get back there and talk to the experts again. Thank you very much for calling. And for the caller who called in who gives showers and bathes people, Lynn in La Crosse called with a suggestion, and she advises using a sponge on a stick so that the lady doesn't have to bend over so often, and there may be, that could work. That could work. So worth a try anyway.
Yeah.
And we'll talk some more about that. We need to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guests, Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Well, whether it's an old injury that you just can't seem to fully recover from, or maybe it's a new twinge that's made an appearance, you may be dealing with some aches and pains, and it can be hard to know just what's an annoyance that eventually is going to go away and what needs medical attention. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we visit with Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault from the UW. They are physical therapists, and great to have them share what they know with you about your aches and pains. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and we have some open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Amanda in Madison says her husband is 34 and has problems with his sciatic nerve. He can feel it coming on, and if he gets the full pain of sciatica, he's in excruciating pain. How do you avoid this pain? He'll be limping and hurting for 2 weeks. And she's wondering if there's exercises or medications or treatments that would help.
Yeah, nerve pain can be pretty excruciating. When a nerve gets irritated or inflamed, and the sciatic nerve runs down the back of the leg, back of the thigh, kind of the hamstring area, and then it splits down into the lower leg. And so typically the pain is in the back of the leg and below the knee. You can get some numbness, tingling, and some burning as well. Probably the most common sites for the sciatic nerve or components of it to get irritated is the low back area, the low lumbar area in particular. There's also area in the deep buttock where the sciatic nerve comes out of the pelvis into the leg where it can also get irritated and inflamed. So in terms of exercises, the part of it is, where's the irritation coming from? Is it the spine? Is it more the hip or a combination of the two? And once a nerve gets irritated, it does not like to be stretched. And so when to help prevent it from getting so bad and getting it back under control, when people walk, they should shorten their stride length. When we walk, it puts a little bit of a stretch on the sciatic nerve. And so if it's irritated, you want to shorten your stride length. Bending, and especially with your knees extended or close to extended, puts a lot of tension on the sciatic nerve. People with sciatica shouldn't be stretching their hamstrings because that also can aggravate the nerve. And so this is where it sounds like this has been going on for a while, where a visit with a physical therapist can help sort out where is the irritation happening. And then there's plan A, and it's to get this under control And that's protecting the nerve and allowing it to heal, and then long-term recovery. So there's different phases in the rehabilitation process.
There we go.
But it can people can be miserable. But sounds like it's time to be seen.
And the good thing is that he can feel it coming on. So if he can be instructed in the steps to take when he starts to feel it, he may be able to prevent the full-blown attack.
And, oh, sure.
And people who have this kind of condition chronically need to learn how to self-manage it, because by the time they get into the medical system, it's usually so difficult to get back. So he's really lucky in some ways that he can feel it coming on and hopefully learn some intervention strategies to prevent it from going to a full-blown sciatica.
Ben in Grafton has a comment for us. Hi, Ben. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment about the young lady, the CNA that was giving baths, about her shoes getting wet. They make a product out there called Vibram, V-I-B-R-A-M. It's a shoe, it's kind of like a glove. And those, my wife is a nurse now. She was a CNA, and she found those very useful. I'm very outdoorsy, so I actually suggested those to her. We got her a pair, and she just loved them. So
those are like the five-finger minimalist running shoes?
Yeah. And they make a variety of different types for different types of situations that, you know, the person may get into, whether it be climbing or running or, you know, whatever they may be doing.
That sounds great.
They're a great product, and you can pick them up at Air One. I know that's a great store to get them at. That's where I frequent. So if she's listening and she wants to try something, I suggest those.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, just to remember that those are very different from the Nike that she was wearing, which is sort of a cushioned, shock-absorbing shoe. This is a minimalist shoe that has no support and no shock absorption. So it may or may not work for her. It may be fantastic, or it may flare a back or a hip or something else. Yeah. I know she had a history of some hip problems. So anyway, anytime you change your shoe wear, no matter which direction you're going, do it gradually so that you can see what the effects are slowly before you have a second problem to deal with.
All right. Thanks again, Ben. Appreciate it. I want to give Dennis in Beaver Dam a chance to join in. Dennis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I recently found out that I had a childhood injury of a broken back, and I've been living with it throughout the years. And I went and seen a surgeon, and he said to get shots right now to take the pain away, to get it within functioning measures. But I'm worried that because it's the two little hook bones that hold your vertebrae from sliding forward, I'm worried that if we don't have anything as with my lifting and stuff with my job, if that would be cause maybe paralyzation or something. The surgeon wasn't real clear on more points to do and how to keep myself safe.
Okay. Yeah, I think from what you're describing, it sounds like you have what's called a spondylolysis, and if there's a slip, then it's called a spondylolisthesis. There's two common areas for fractures in the spine. One is the front of the spine, the vertebral body. And then you have these two hooks, are called facet joints, in the back of the back, and that's the more common fracture in kids and in adolescents. The fact you have the fractures doesn't mean that there is going to be a slip. And from a neurological standpoint, it's really unusual to have any kind of severe or significant nerve damage, especially related to a fracture that happened, sounds like decades ago, a long time ago. Now, it sounds like you're doing lifting and bending with work. It's really important, Dennis, that you have good hip flexibility. So as was mentioned earlier, so when you do bend and twist and move, the more your hips can do, the less your back has to do. And so having good hip flexibility, both in the back of the hips and the front of the hips, is really important. And then strengthening. And basically you view it as you've got a defect in that area, so you need to compensate. And the injections are one thing to get the pain under control, but in terms of long-term prevention and just long-term health, you need to be a little stronger compared to someone who doesn't have that history of fracture. And so strengthening around the hips and the trunk are really important for you. Have you seen a physical therapist along the way at all?
No, this just happened recently, so now we're starting to set up this type of plan. I haven't got the reports yet, so I don't know what's going on.
Okay. Are you having any symptoms into your legs?
All kinds of pain, numbness, feels like it's going to sleep, all the way down to my ankle.
Okay.
All
right. And have they done an MRI?
Or are they yes, going? They did. That's how they found out that the disc actually slipped forward, and that's how they found out my back was broke when I was in childhood years. I'm in my 50s.
Okay. All right. Yeah, actually, there are a lot of people who have this type of condition and don't know it. And a number of people who have it and have minimal symptoms, so you're not necessarily doomed forever. The key is what's your neurological status, and that relates to numbness and weakness and any bowel and bladder changes. If you're not dealing with those things, then what you need is a really good rehabilitation program, you know, kind of designed around the things that I mentioned, to give you the best chance to hopefully avoid surgery. So, again, it sounds like you've had the appropriate tests, and they'll be able to determine your neurological status, which is really critical in terms of how urgent do you need an injection or surgery. And if the answer is no, then a really good rehabilitation program gives you a good chance.
Good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have an email, I believe, or a Facebook comment from Deb in Rockdale. My 61-year-old husband suffered through a herniated disc for months. He did PT and it's better, but he thinks the problem should be 100% resolved and he'll have the back of a 20-year-old again. I, however, think he needs to continue preventive practices, not twisting or lifting too much, that sort of thing. Can he expect the herniated disc to be totally resolved, or will this be an ongoing age-related issue?
Oh, boy. The crystal ball says it can be either. There are times it resolves and resolves completely where people don't have any more than the little stiffness that most of us have in our backs at different times. If it truly was a herniated disc, even if he's feeling well, the disc is not normal. You don't get a restoration of the height of the disc, and if there was a bulging disc, that typically stays bulging. So it's important that he maintains, you know, good general conditioning. Again, he needs good hip flexibility and strengthening. A program that combines those things gives him his best chance of staying healthy and feeling good. So I would err on the side of Deb's opinion that continuing on with doesn't need to have to be the same program he was doing that got him out of trouble, but that's what the therapist should be working with him is kind of plan B. Now that things are under control, what can he do to keep this from coming back again?
Okay.
And that's not a 24/7 process, and usually that kind of program you can work into somebody's lifestyle pretty easily.
Steve in Montreal, Wisconsin has a question for you. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me on. About 4 years ago, I had rotator cuff surgery. Range of motion is not an issue, but the pain at best is mild, leading to excruciating, and a couple of times has gone on beyond that. I've done some PT, including plenty of Iron County snow shoveling. I didn't retire to be having to live like this.
Yeah.
I have been told that heavy applications of vitamin D can help on pain relief. I don't know. That sounds too easy to be true. Give me some help here.
Well, you are very wise. It is too good to be true. You know, you can try it. One of the issues about vitamin D is it's a fat-soluble vitamin. So if you take lots and lots and lots of it, it can become toxic. So that would be my first advice about it. The second thing is if you're doing lots of Iron County snow shoveling, tell you, if you've had a rotator cuff problem, snow shoveling, raking, vacuuming are at the top of the list of things that annoy your rotator cuff. So you might do well by some activity modification. So if I had a rotator cuff surgery, I probably wouldn't be snow shoveling.
Snowblower?
Yeah, I mean,
even
you can
that?
See it typically pushing. I mean, if you think about lifting a rake forward and pulling, or pushing a vacuum forward, or pushing a snow shovel, or pushing a snow blower, those are all activities that are really hard on your rotator cuff.
Oftentimes, snow blowers are pulling you around.
Right, right. So, Steve, in terms of your rotator cuff surgery, what did they do? Was it a repair?
Well, now, I wasn't in a position to observe.
Okay, but...
Except that the range of motion is 100%.
Okay. Did they tell you you had a tear?
I do not recall.
Okay. And may I ask your age?
Only 71.
Oh, so good. All right. Well, you know, chances are at 71, you don't have a lot of rotator cuff left, especially if you had surgery. If you had surgery, it's unlikely that they repaired it. What they probably did was went in and they cleaned stuff out. So my guess is you don't have a very well-functioning rotator cuff. So, you know, I'd go with activity modification. You're better off. You're more likely to get success than with taking a lot of vitamin D. And if you don't have a maintenance strengthening program for your shoulder, I would do that. And your response may be, but I'm already very physically active. What tends to happen is you tend to overwork some muscles and underwork others. So the purpose of the therapy program is to achieve some balance and strengthen the muscles who can take over for your rotator cuff.
Well, how does that fit with my downhill skiing?
It should work just fine.
Well, that's good, because as we have started to speak, it is snowing heavily.
All right. So help the economy and hire someone to do your shoveling for you, and you go ski. You're 71, for goodness sake. Go have fun.
Just stay upright when you're skiing.
Exactly.
That'll help your rotator cuff.
The fall on your shoulder will make your rotator cuff very unhappy.
Okay. Well, I tell you what. Get your skis and get your sleds and come up here to beautiful Iron County.
All right.
It is a beautiful county. I agree with you there, Steve. But, hey, take Lori's advice. Get somebody to do that shoveling for you. You don't need to do that yourself.
That's
anymore.
Right. Go have fun.
Have fun. All right. Let's turn to Tom in Hollandale next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I have what I believe to be bursitis in my left shoulder. It's odd to me how it works. When I wake up in the morning, it's extremely painful unless I keep my elbow close to my body. And as soon as I move my elbow away from my body, it's like a sharp pain. I walk around the house holding my elbow like a goof. But then I can function normally. I can go outside, carry firewood, carry my shotgun, shovel snow. I can do anything without pain or a problem all day. Most of the time, that is. And then I go to bed, and in the morning, it starts all over again. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So how long is it sore in the morning? You walk around holding your elbow for how long before you can do stuff?
Half an hour.
Okay, and then the pain just goes away?
It just slowly goes away, yeah, and I can start moving. It seems like the more I move it, the faster it resolves after it. I'm able to move it without much pain.
Okay, well, that's the good news.
It seems to me like a burst is a bag of fluid, right?
Yes, sir, yes it is. So what tends to happen?
It seems like it's under pressure, and the pressure is relieving somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that. It could also be some arthritis in your shoulder. Because your joints like to move. So when they're stationary all night long, they get stiff, and moving it hurts until you get up, get things moving, you get the synovial fluid bathing your joint surfaces, and then they feel pretty good unless you overdo it. So it may be that kind of a deal. In terms of the morning, what you might look at is how you're sleeping. Do you know what position your left shoulder is in when you're sleeping? I mean, do you wake up with it in a certain way?
Well, I'm 72, and I sleep horribly. So I sleep every conceivable position.
Okay.
It doesn't hurt to lay on that arm. In fact, sometimes I lay on that arm to keep it from moving into a position that will make it painful.
Okay. You know, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. I mean, you could try taking an anti-inflammatory before you go to bed, but you're probably doing stuff like that because you don't sleep well anyway. But it sounds a little bit like more of an arthritis thing than a bursitis thing, because the bursa really wouldn't decrease in size or inflammation that quickly during the day. It sounds more like your shoulder gets lubricated, and once you get the synovial fluid going, you feel better. So before you get out of bed, you may try just moving your arm around a little bit to start to get like the oil bathing the engine a little bit before you get out of bed, and maybe that will help with it. But there's not really a good intervention that's going to change that symptom in the morning. Keeping your shoulders strong is going to be key.
Tom, a type of exercise that is gentle and kind of on Lori's premise of kind of lubricating the joint is once you're out of bed, you stand and you bear your weight on your right hand on a table or a counter, lean forward a little bit. Just let that left arm hang. And then you just gently swing that arm forward and backward, side to side, make little circles with it. And you don't push it hard, but you unweight the joint, and then with gravity, you gently swing it in these different directions. And that can help get it lubricated. So whatever little move you can do before you get out of bed, and then maybe just spend a couple minutes doing that when you first get out of bed, and that may speed up that process for you.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Jennifer on Facebook said she was diagnosed with plantar fasciitis after dancing barefoot while pregnant, she says. After suffering through 8 years with physical therapy and antibiotics, only moderate improvement, she found a chiropractor who knew how to adjust feet. This worked. I still need to go back every 6 to 12 months, but this foot adjustment made a huge difference that physical therapy didn't address.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea, this is kind of a premise what Lori brings up frequently, is what causes it, whether you're talking about this condition or a tendonitis or a bursitis, and why in that one leg. And there's times joint mobility can be impacted, or posture of the foot can be impacted, and manipulation or adjustments can help normalize the stress coming through the foot. And, you know, if she only has to go back every 6 or 12 months for a quick tune-up or two, and that takes care of it, she's in the right place.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
fantastic.
Absolutely. Liz wonders what your thoughts are on following a PT program prior to having a knee replaced. It seems that PT would facilitate healing and help in the rehab.
Yeah, we often see people we call it prehab, and that is coming in for rehabilitation prior to the surgery. And typically we don't see people on an ongoing basis, but we'll see them once or twice to set them up on an exercise program. So often for people with knee replacements, we put them in a pool to do walking and strengthening exercises and stretching, because the better shape that knee is in prior to surgery, the better their recovery will be. And as Bill alluded to earlier, we want to make sure we have good mobility in the hip and ankle adjacent joints, because they're going to have to compensate for a while for the knee. So we want to make sure those joints are as healthy as they can be prior to surgery.
Mm. And one listener said acupuncture cured her sciatica 100%. Everyone is different, but it's something to look into. If you've got sciatica, maybe acupuncture can help.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. It's been around for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And go to someone who's licensed, and it's a good vehicle.
Yep, we offer some of those services at UW Spine as well.
Oh.
Acupuncture, massage, pain management, all those support systems that help people who are having chronic pain.
Well, Bill and Lori, thank you so much. You're going to be back next year, of course.
Next year. Oh,
that's right. That's right. That's right. Martin Luther King Day.
Yes.
January 20th, Monday. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You
appreciate
bet. Stay safe.
Pleasure
and
as always, yes.
Have a great new year.
Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody from the University of Wisconsin. Bill's a professor in the School of Medicine Public Health. Lori, a professor, but also a physical therapist and athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine. And they will be back on January 20th. Thank you for listening. Paul Novak talks about holiday baking tomorrow on the Ideas Network.